VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and today is a special day because we have visiting from us from the great northeast of England, George Culkin. He will be with us in the studio, and obviously I am extremely delighted, as I am by the fact that Matt Hughes also made the trek into town to be with us, and so did Rory Smith. But there's more, because in our debate today, we're going to be joined down the phone by Matthew Syed. We're going to be talking about youth development, realistic expectations of what we can expect, and I suspect a little bit of nature versus nurture as well. We're also going to be taking a look at Swansea's new managerial appointment, and we're also going to be talking through the weekend's action, starting, of course, with the two juggernauts of English football, Liverpool and Manchester United at Anfield. Right off the bat, Hughesy, why was this game so bad? My friend Mark Chapman, who presents Match of the Day 2, tweeted at halftime and basically said, and I'm paraphrasing there, this game bites the big one. We're going to go and show some Sunday League action instead because it really is that bad. And this is a guy who's paid to promote football, of course.
Yeah, it wasn't a good game. Bottom line is two pretty average teams. United, very defensive.
Were they really that defensive again?
Under Van Gaal, that is their kind of modus operandi, really, to defend first. They're going to Anfield, so they're going to try and first and foremost stay in the game. Liverpool in a state of transition, haven't got any goal scorers. I think what was the stat of their starting lineup had scored 6 Premier League goals between them all season, which is astonishing.
Not good.
It's no surprise they didn't score yesterday, is it, against the best defence in the country.
If only they had a big, prolific, expensive centre forward.
Well, they do, but they don't play him because Brendan's on him and Brendan isn't there. Brendan's in the Sky studio.
Telling us about all the signings that he was about to make, but that he was scuppered by the evil transfer committee. This Benteke thing, all right, at what point does it become a problem? Because I'm a Kloppite. I like Jurgen Klopp. I want him to do well. I'm on board. You're looking cynical, but I think
I'm also a Klopp.
Okay, all right. We're part of Jurgen's army. But by the same token, there's the sort of eternal diatribe between having a system and getting players to fit into it and picking your system based on the players you have. If you have this guy and he is your big signing and he's your stud center forward, and given his age profile, he could be for the next 10 years, should he be doing more of an effort to get him on?
Yeah, I think there's a... There's a curiosity to... Hughes is right that Liverpool lack goals. I think what's really interesting about the fact that Liverpool lack goals is that if you look at most of their games, they seem to have about 23-24 shots every single time they play. If you speak to your evil number wizards, they will tell you that all of those shots are Coutinho long ranges and they are from terrible positions. They're shooting from bad places, Liverpool, which explains that...
0.8 rough expected goals, according to Michael Cayley.
There you go. Discrepancy. Look at that. Isn't the game... The game is so modern. Oh. Yeah, so if you look at that, that's the discrepancy there. Lots of shots, lots of attacking play, no goals, it's just they're shooting from bad areas. Benteke... reminds me, and this is not necessarily the perfect comparison. Dortmund, when they lost Lewandowski, brought two strikers in under Klopp. Those two strikers were Gab,
Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, Adrian Ramos, and Ciro Immobile.
Of which Aubameyang obviously is doing brilliantly now. Adrian Ramos, who plays in a similar way to Benteke, he is a big, powerful, proper centre forward, proper bull centre forward. Didn't do very well at all at Borussia Dortmund. Neither did Immobile. And I wonder whether Klopp, who looked at Benteke to fill that gap. That they eventually signed Ramos for. I think Klopp doesn't think Benteke can do that, but you are right. If you have a shortage of goals, if you have a player like Benteke, who is relatively easy to service, Benteke needs balls into the box, either to feet or from the wing.
And Liverpool have so many natural wingers, so it's a no-brainer.
They don't have that many natural wingers, but they do have two very attacking fullbacks who can provide width in Klein and Moreno. it seems odd that they have that he seems to have decided that that is just not going to work.
So it seems odd. It also seems self-defeating because he may not be the ideal centre forward for Klopp long term because he's not mobile enough. He doesn't move enough. He doesn't get outside the penalty area, does he? Really? But given you need goals, given Sturridge is never fit, given Firmino's not a striker, surely you play him this season, get through the season, and worry about the kind of the system and the model next year.
It says a lot about Liverpool's resources that they. I mean, it's also something that I absolutely love that they brought on a centre half to play up front for the last few minutes. You don't see that enough anymore. I mean, it's one of. I love that. I genuinely love that, but it's also quite embarrassing, really, when you think about it. Bringing on Stephen Corker to play up front.
I always remember Gerard Houllier at Arsenal once. They were 1-0 down Liverpool, and they had I'm giving things away here. They had five strikers on the pitch at the end. I remember thinking, even as a teenager, you're sort of thinking, just you've got loads of strikers on the pitch, people standing in the box. Yeah. That doesn't mean you're going to score a goal. The point is you have to create chances, no matter how many strikers you've got. It is a sign of desperation. It's not great. I think Sturridge, Benteke and the fact that Klopp doesn't like him is an issue. Sturridge gives, through no real fault of his own, Sturridge gives them an enormous problem, just in terms of what to do with him.
Because he's not there.
It's a really difficult one for any manager. With a player who can be that good when he's not injured, what do? Do you buy another striker and just assume that Sturridge isn't going to be there? Do you hope that Sturridge can come back and not go and spend a lot of money? That's a really genuinely difficult issue.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, it was a poor game, but Liverpool were by far the better team in the first half. And what they didn't have movement. They didn't have movement in the box. They didn't have somebody on the end of chances. They didn't have someone running onto those chances, onto the balls in that part of the field. Sturridge, you think, would be able to do that? Benteke doesn't fit into that system naturally, I don't think, but it feels self-defeating to have that capability of scoring goals on the bench not being played.
George, I want to ask you about two guys with Northeast roots who you would have seen sort of in previous incarnations and who've now become mainstays for Liverpool and for England, and that's Henderson and Milner. I mean, I know Milner came from Leeds, but obviously he spent time at Newcastle. I really, really like Henderson. I like him a lot more than Milner, but I like Milner too. But I'm just wondering, are these modern, have they developed into the type of players you expected them to when you saw them when they were younger? Because it strikes me that Milner was more about quality, perhaps, than when he was younger. Not that he lacks it now, but now it seems more about sort of tactics and positioning and filling holes. And whereas I think Henderson, he showed a lot of personality to me when he was younger, when breaking in, but...
Yeah.
Today it seems to me that he's kind of being asked to do too much in that Liverpool midfield. I mean, are they kind of where you expected them to be? Can you talk about what they were like when they were younger?
Henderson, when he broke into things at Sunderland, I think there was a sense that he had that he could develop, but there's also a sense of not quite understanding what his role was. He should score more goals. He should be able to tackle. There was a kind of funny, famous story about Steve Bruce going into the dressing room after one defeat and saying, what is it that you actually do, son? And I think since he's moved to Liverpool, it's clear what he can do. And he's developed into a really fine player. Now, whether he's doing too much, whether the captaincy is too much, I don't know, because I don't see them enough to talk about that. But I'm very pleased to see the player that he's developed into. Milner has always been about running. He's become far more than that and has become more effective, I think. And it probably says a lot about the coaching at Newcastle that there didn't seem to be much end product at the end of his game. He was played on the wing. He didn't look like a natural winger for all the speed that he had. And of course, as so many players do, he goes somewhere else and immediately becomes more effective, or over time becomes more effective.
It's a Newcastle effect.
Well, sadly, yeah.
I think they're both victims of their versatility and work ethic and really positive attitude in a good way. And, I mean, if you ask James Milner, if he's here today, he would still say he wants to be an attacking central midfielder, really, but he's barely been allowed to be because he's always kind of fits in and does the job, covers on the left, covers on the right, even covers in the two deeper roles. And Henderson's the same, almost, because of Liverpool's shortages in other areas of the pitch. He's, as you say, asked to do too much. And they both do it very willingly because they are both very good professionals and good blokes, to be honest.
I think what Hughesy says about being cursed by versatility is a really good point. That both, and there's a lot of that at Liverpool generally, there's a lot of players who are quite good at a few things, but there's not that many who are outstanding at one thing. Emre Can's quite a good holding midfielder. He's not a bad...
No, he's another guy who's who played centre-back.
Yeah.
Going back when he was younger, he played right-back.
Emre Can, good footballer, no question about that, but doesn't... You don't look at him and think he is... your kind of number one pick to play this exact role and to do this exact job. And I think there's a lot of that at Liverpool. The one thing I'd say about Milner and Henderson, both should theoretically be perfect for Klopp.
Why? Because they're all fluid and they can do a bit of everything.
Well, no, they're both very, very good at playing a press.
Right. So very is Lallana.
So Lallana this is a weird thing to say. Lallana, who has no end product whatsoever, is an excellent presser of the ball. There you go. That is a thinly veiled compliment.
This is probably the wrong thing to say in this company, but isn't pressing the ball the most overrated and easiest thing to do?
I can press the ball,
but I'm terrible at football, but I can run around the ball.
That's absolutely right, it is.
And I can do what I'm told by a shouty German, I imagine.
I should be playing for
Liverpool.
You should be. No, you are right. Pressing should be a
given, really.
It's not a skill.
It's an essential component, and I think people have kind of overrated it, because if you can play football, you can break a press.
But if you speak to managers, and there'll be managers out there who, and I suspect Klopp might be one of them, who will tell you that Benteke can't press. I don't think anyone can't press. I think some players won't press.
Why does he think he can't press? Because he's so big and like...
I don't know. I'm not saying... I don't know why. But right. there are managers out there who think that certain players can't press.
Here's what you can do between now and the end of the show. You can come up with a player of Benteke's size and body profile who's really good at pressing. A little task for you. Right. You'll get a couple of house points for that. I want to turn it over to Wayne Rooney, because... obviously, it's now 5 goals in 4 games after going through a tough spell. Van Gaal made it a point of pride. And by the way, we all saw what happened with Neil Costas. It does seem to me like, I don't know how to read this. I don't know if I should read it as if Van Gaal put so much faith in Rooney because he has nobody else, or if he really thought that Rooney would somehow turn the corner. Has he turned the corner, or did he just score a really important goal?
He's been playing better gradually over time. I think I was here 2 weeks ago after he scored the brilliant goal against Swansea. And
when we got the whole technical dissection of what he did from Julian Lawrence.
That's right, yeah. You could probably do that. I certainly couldn't.
And but you can press better than Julian Lawrence, I'm sure.
Undoubtedly.
Jules properly presses. He's a buddy to play with, Jules. He makes you run around and stuff.
You're asking to come up with somebody who has Benteke's body type and press as well. Julian Lawrence does not have Benteke's body type.
He does not, no.
Before I was so rudely interrupted,
sorry.
I was better. So Rooney, I don't think he was ever as bad as people were saying. He's always had these lulls in his career, and he had an extended one first half of this season, really, not helped by playing in a team that were stifled and passed the ball sideways all the time. It must be very frustrating to play up front for Man United because you just don't get any service. It's good that he's hit a little bit of form, but I still think United need more attacking options.
That's absolutely right. But I mean, they're incredibly ponderous. I mean, they are absolutely ponderous. And
you saw them at their best.
Yeah. Well, I saw them at Newcastle last week, and it was a good game, which was amazing in every respect, because I haven't seen any good games there either. But they're incredible. And I've seen a couple of their European games, and they're so slow and so ponderous. But Rooney has still got those instincts, but I don't think he's, you know, I think he's lost his sharpness in the same way. And I think Tony Cascarino made that point for us, that saying that, you know, Rooney's 30 now, but 30 is no longer the peak in the Premier League. 30 years past it. I mean, that's possibly slightly harsh, but the sort of 28, 26, 27 is the sort of age when you're looking at players to peak now. And I think he's just not the player that he was. I think he's a different kind of player. It doesn't mean he's not good. He's not the same.
It's that old football thing of not wanting to accept that people age. It happened with Gerrard that there's this sort of idea that they should be sort of immortal and be their 27, 28 year old selves forever. They're not. Rooney is not as good as he used to be. That's just there was a lull. Hughes is right. The first half of the season, he was particularly poor. Don't know whether you can call like 4 months a lull. It's a bit longer than a lull. But yeah, it was a particularly poor patch of form. But Rooney ultimately isn't quite as good as he used to be. And he is going to continue to not be as good as he once was. And we can't continually say, oh, well, you know, Rooney's going to be back. The Rooney that existed when he was 25 is not returning, because Wayne Rooney's not 25 anymore. That's not coming back at all. The one thing I wanted, I did the radio yesterday, I was at Stoke, not watching the Liverpool game. But I think it was Robbie Savage said that Rooney's kind of, Van Gaal needed his captain, and Rooney's, you know, he's done what a captain does. It's what a captain does not prevent the manager getting into a crisis in the first place. You can't say that he's been a captain when Van Gaal's in trouble if he wasn't being a captain beforehand, can you?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he has responded at a time when United were seriously, and the manager was seriously under pressure, so that is to his credit. I think you're right, he's not at his best, but equally, if we'd been here 10 years ago, would we have said Wayne Rooney's still Man United England captain, age of 30, given he came into the team at 16, given his body type, given his various off-field scrapes? I think he's done pretty well to extend his career as far as it has, and I hope he gets those six goals and catches Sir Bobby by the end of the season.
I want to leave with one other point. Now, we criticise managers when they make mistakes, and I'm wondering if maybe we should deliver a little bit of praise to Louis van Gaal because he's so likeable and kind to the media. He's supposedly all conservative and boring, right? But it's 0-0. You're away from home to Liverpool. He could have kept it at 0-0, right? Instead, he sends on Mata and Memphis, two really attacking players, and he goes for it. Does that earn him any kind of praise, or does it just earn him a stern rebuke for not playing those guys in the first place and subjecting us to Lingard instead?
They scored with their only shot on target.
But he put the good guys on, right? No?
But yeah, but in a very, very average game, he went for it. I mean, it's like went for it. That makes it sound slightly more dramatic and exciting and entertaining and daring and adventurous than it was when it wasn't.
I'm not sure Mata, I love Mata. I'm not actually sure he's necessarily an attacking substitution, is he, Mata? Not always. Mata's there to retain the ball.
Sorry, Louis, I apologise. I'm really trying. All right, let's move to the Britannia, Stoke and Arsenal. Obviously, this is a fixture with some history. It was kind of another dull game.
It was really bad.
In many ways. You were there.
I was there.
And you were there with Robbie Savage.
We were on the radio. Really
bad. I was on the radio, yeah.
Okay, just to clarify.
Just to make sure. Both goalkeepers were excellent, but the game itself was forgettable.
Hughesy, if I was to put to you this argument that, okay, so Arsenal weren't great, but Arsenal were also without Ozil and Sanchez and Cazorla, arguably their three most skillful players, plus Coughlin, who for some reason is very important for him. No, but he is. He's very important to his Arsenal team. So going in, you know, not playing as well as you might otherwise, I mean, it's a pretty good alibi. And should we maybe instead praise them for showing grit and determination and mental toughness and all those things that, you know, Arsenal being a soft, froggy southern team supposedly lack?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think this Arsenal team is soft. If they concede a goal away from home, that's an issue for them. So it's more sort of a bit of a mental issue rather than, you know, physical softness. They're not. I mean, Flamini, Mertesacker, Cech, Joel Campbell. You know, these pretty physical, imposing specimens. So they're not going to get bullied in the way that they did, and they showed that yesterday. That's what they're almost teasing us, aren't they? We're desperate, although we're enjoying the unpredictability of the Premier League and the title race. We're kind of almost waiting for a team to just stamp their authority on it, and Arsenal haven't quite done that. City have wobbled, and they've not quite taken advantage, which, you know, is going to leave us with a really interesting 3 months. But if you're an Arsenal fan, I guess you're just wanting that a little bit more, because they've got decent points there, but they've got some really tough away games to finish the season. They've got to go to Everton, they've got to Manchester twice, Spurs, West Ham. They've won one of their last six away games. If they're going to win the league, they need to start turning some of these draws into victories.
That's amazing, that, isn't it? Arsenal, so what was that? They've won one of their last six away games.
Yeah.
Man City haven't put back-to-back wins together since October.
Mm. Yeah.
Incredible.
Away from home, yeah.
Wow. Must be why Leicester are top of the table.
The one thing that struck me yesterday was that there was a bit of a... We've all seen that... Everyone knows about like the whole Stoke Alona thing and how Mark Hughes has, to his immense credit, sort of turned Stoke into a much more attractive side. Which isn't always the case, but is broadly true. The thing that struck me on an extraordinarily cold day at the Britannia, when nothing...
Tell us
was
again, was it cold?
It was absolute... I'm torn as to whether...
Hard Yorkshireman, ladies and gentlemen.
I did a piece for Saturday's paper about why Arsenal's so bad at Stoke, and tried to speak to people at Arsenal, around Arsenal, about why this was, and one of the reasons that they kept coming out with is it's very windy.
It wasn't actually, do you know what, I would have been glad of a bit of wind.
Made me laugh.
It is windy. That opened by the stadium,
yeah.
Gusts
in the same way as Sunderland, it distracts teams that there's always quite a lot of litter on the pitch.
Yeah, it's the great intro you want to do. There was a lot of rubbish on the pitch and blah 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 blah.
But it really was extremely cold. But the thing that struck me was that you had these patches where Stoke were playing really nice football, and then Arsenal were being incredibly sort of dogged and resilient. And then you went into the press conference and you heard Wenger praising the fighting spirit of his side, and Mark Hughes saying how beautiful that Stoke's football was. And it was a bit like the entire world had been turned upside down.
You're always looking for sort of, you know, finally there'll be a good English or Welsh manager.
Or Welsh. How often have you heard someone in the pubs and clubs?
Because I was going to make a point about Mark. Well, you know, Roy Sanchez, you know, we discussed Chris Coleman many times and, you know, how he could have been so much more. But anyway.
Good Welsh manager. Long wait for...
Okay, I would have said British manager, but then y'all would have thrown Fergie back into my face or somebody else. So
you want to know whether Mark Hughes is better than we all give him credit for?
Kind of. And I want to know if, in the eyes of the big clubs, he hasn't been permanently disqualified by his experience at City, which wasn't actually that bad, was it?
I don't think it's the thing at City that puts people off. I think partly his nationality, despite the fact we are all waiting for the next great Welsh manager. But also, I think it's his Blackburn team that puts people off more than anything. It's the reputation of that Blackburn team. He's been sidetracked. I think so, yeah.
I think there is a bit of that.
The club's so thick that they're like, oh, look, 7 years ago, this team played rubbish football. Okay, let's never appoint him again. I mean,
reputation stick in football, you know that.
Yeah, but yes and no. I mean, Goose Hiddink.
Ranieri, it was 11 years ago that he made some changes to his team and he came back and it was always the Tinker Man.
Yes, but that's also because y'all are in Ireland and he went away. So he was kind of frozen in time in 2004. That's all you remember. But I mean, Hughes has been here for a while. We've seen him, right?
Mark Hughes has always been a very good manager.
What's the problem? Is it Kia?
I think the problem is twofold. Like the problem is the very biggest clubs, they like a bit of stardust, a bit of sexiness. He is not that. He will never be that.
He only played for Manchester United and Barcelona.
Yeah, but just in terms of the way he...
And Bayern.
In terms of his career trajectory, the biggest clubs don't appoint managers from Stoke or Blackburn. They just don't. And Mark Hughes' persona, he's a straight-talking guy, but he's quite slightly dour. So I think there's that. There's partly the big clubs just don't even look there. Secondly, although his career has been very good, he did have that rocky period of 2 or 3 years where he was almost a bit guilty of being overambitious. His agent tried to get him the Chelsea job, told him he was going to get the Chelsea job.
It's his advisor, not his agent.
Then he screwed over Fulham.
He did really well at Fulham.
Get all these
crappy players at Fulham.
No, but he walked out because he thought he was going to get Chelsea, didn't he?
And then he ended up getting QPR and didn't get Chelsea.
Okay. But I think his career's gone very well, apart from that period. Right. And that's cost him, really. I
mean, so he should just give up but realistically, will he get a top six shot?
No,
it's not likely, no.
I think he recognised that he had to attempt to put down roots at Stoke and make a go of it and think of this. I mean, to get a job in the Premier League is pretty good, for one thing, for anybody, and to kind of focus on it and concentrate on it if he stays there long. I mean, the way they're playing at the minute, I mean, I don't think you can underestimate what he's done, because he's completely changed the narrative of how we look at Stoke. You know, now it used to be a touching, what do you call it, a touching post. Touching post, is that the right word?
Yeah, I think so.
Touchstone. Well, going to Stoke on a cold, windy day, whatever, used to be kind of one of the great cliches of the Premier League, and now it's still very difficult to go there, but for very different reasons. Mm. They're a good football team. So he's sort of reinvented himself a bit, and I think the longer he stays there doing that,
right,
there's a chance.
The reason that big clubs won't look at it is partly the fashion thing, and that can't be ignored. But it's also that if you're Man City or Man United or Arsenal or Chelsea or whoever, you want someone who has the specific skill set that is applicable to you. And getting Jonathan Walters and Jeff Cameron to play good football isn't what the manager of Chelsea has to do.
All those clubs,
for very valid reasons, will only look at managers who've done it in Europe and been successful in Europe.
Yeah, all right, no. That's,
and he obviously hasn't done that because he hasn't had the opportunity, which is unfair.
So you are in a catch-22, but there is a logic behind that catch-22.
But I want to leave this segment with this. Which of these three British managers would you like to have for your club? You must pick one. Sparky, Pards, or Howie? That would be Steve Howie.
Well, I'll take Steve Howie. He'd name me as number two.
Yeah. You don't need to explain it. You have to pick one of those three.
Eddie Howe.
I'd take Hughes at the moment, as long as he brought Shaqiri with him.
You wouldn't want any of those guys.
No, Eddie Howe. Eddie Howe.
There you go.
But a night out with Pards.
All right, speaking of new managers, Swansea have a new head coach who, as I understand it, will be working alongside Alan Curtis. And by the way,
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Apologize to whoever I offended out there when I suggested that, you know, they now have some guy named Alan Curtis. Of course, Alan Curtis was a great Welsh international and so on.
But he's not the next great Welsh manager.
Probably not the great Welsh manager. But the new manager is Francesco Guidolin. So Francesco Guidolin is a guy, he's now 60 years old. He made his name in the mid-90s, he worked his way up. He took Vicenza, he won the Coppa Italia with Vicenza. Bounced around different clubs, never really got the job at a big club. Some people said that actually it was because maybe the same reason Martin O'Neill didn't, in the sense that he was considered a little bit studious, different, not sort of Jack the Lad. I mean, he's managed like a million clubs, but he was at Udinese, where he took Udinese into the Champions League, played some pretty nice football. He left Udinese in 2014, I think, had some sort of advisory role with a club. And I remember when I spoke to him, you know, he said that he'd love to have a crack in England. But he was also realistic that given his age and given, you know, he was studying English, it probably wasn't going to happen. But now it did. Now it has happened. Rory?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is that Swansea have clearly erred in sacking Gary Monk. Not does he shouldn't have been sacked. That's a difficult one to call. But because they obviously hadn't even thought about who they might realistically get to replace him, which is very unlike Swansea. Yeah.
You never believed in the whole Bielsa thing?
No, I think they thought about Bielsa and Sampaoli, but I think they should have probably done a bit of research and worked out whether they could get them or not.
Right.
It was realistic. Their argument is that they didn't foresee the need to sack Monk. I don't think that quite holds water on the grounds that they won one of 11 games at some point in that run.
It took
about
3 months to sack him.
Yeah,
the stories that he was in trouble started in September.
If you look at that run, then at some point it occurs to you, hang on, we better work out who's next in line. Guidolin, I remember from the mid-90s in Italy. I remember speaking to Gino Pozzo about him when he was at Udinese.
Were you like 5 years old in the mid-90s? What do you remember?
No, I was in my teens. Right. Yeah, come on, okay. Crying out loud. I remember that Vicenza team played Chelsea in the Turkish Cup, in fact. Mm-hmm. Guidolin's Vicenza. He is kind of a jobbing Italian manager to an extent, but at Udinese he did very well, as you say. I think twice they got them into the Champions League, didn't they?
Into the qualifiers,
yeah. At one point they lost certainly one to Arsenal. They may have lost both to Arsenal. They seem to play Arsenal a lot for a while. But he's quite attacking, which will work with Swansea. I'm going to bow to your wisdom, Dad, whether he's a 4-3-3 or 3-4-3 man.
He is one of those guys who annoy some players, but one of those Italian guys who's hyper-tactical, who spends a lot of time in front of the blackboard, or certainly did in the past, or the iPad, I guess, now, with a projection screen, and he wants players who can play all sorts of different positions. He's done back threes, he's done back fours, he's done, you know, he adapts to the players, but he is quite demanding tactically.
I mean, when you heard that, Swansea, obviously, I suppose quite strangely for Premier League teams, or maybe it should be more common, but they have a very, very recognisable system that it's served them well over various managers, and they have a very recognisable style as well. And when you heard this news, did you think, oh, well, that makes some kind of logical sense? Oh, yeah, okay.
No, I thought the opposite. And again, not because he can't play that possession-based football, but simply because you hear so many people talk about how important it is to have Premier League experience, you need to know the league. I think of other guys. I mean, Pepe Mel is the first name that comes to mind. You know, foreign managers being thrown in there who've never worked here can be difficult. And obviously they are, I mean, as we tape this, they're in the relegation zone. If this is a pondered choice, then they would have looked at it, and I think it can be a good fit. If it's kind of like, oh, shoot, you know, it's been 3 months now without Monk, and Curtis is still here, and let's go and get the first guy we find, you know.
The only other thing is that no one in this Premier League can defend. So if you can bring in a coach who can teach you how to defend, even vaguely, you're probably staying up, to be perfectly honest.
Joining us for this segment, we're very fortunate to have Matthew Syed on with us. Now, this was the week that FIFA banned Atletico and Real Madrid for two transfer windows for irregularities over the transfer of minors. It's basically the same thing that happened to Barcelona. Long story short, for those who don't know this, is so basically you can only sign a guy from a foreign country if he's a minor in one of three circumstances. One is if their family moves for non-footballing reasons. One is if you're right on the border and they're from less than 100 kilometers or 60 miles away, but across a national border. And the third is if it's a transfer within the European Union, because of course it's one big market. Yay. Now, first of all, Roy, we need to knock this on the head. And I'll go to you first because you've written extensively about this. While the ban is for two transfer windows starting from this summer and then next winter, there is probably a greater chance of Chelsea winning the Premier League this season than there is of Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid actually being banned this summer, right?
Yeah, so I think what's important is that Atletico came out straight away. Enrique Cerezo said that they would contest it. Jose Angel Sanchez then came out the same evening, I think, and said that Madrid would take it, first of all, to the FIFA appeals panel, then, if necessary, to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, as Barcelona did. I think, realistically, Real particularly say that they have done nothing wrong, and they say that this is FIFA. I think it will be upheld. That process of appeal will take 8 months if Barcelona's
It took about eight and a half months yeah. In Barcelona's case. Barcelona banned in April. The FIFA appeal was rejected in late August, and then the CAS verdict came December 30th. So all this nonsense like, oh no, they're stuck with Cristiano Ronaldo and Gareth Bale won't be able to move and all this stuff, it's all absolute nonsense, right?
Well, it's not nonsense. I think it has to be taken into consideration the fact that that 8 month process would end in sort of August, early September. They will get this summer, January now, and this summer to act, and then they will effectively be banned for all of 2017.
If
it's upheld. I think that's the most likely thing. But I do think Real probably have to factor it in, because there's no guarantee that the process will take 8.5 months, just as it did for Barcelona. You can't guarantee that. They have to think about it.
You can't.
I would say.
Yeah, they have to think about it now, but what they won't do is ban them sort of in the middle of the summer from one day to the next. If they're not banned by
July 1st, yeah.
I think it's even earlier than that, actually. I want to start with you, Matthew, because I was interested in the defense that Barcelona put up at the time of their ban. Is going to be quite different from Atletico and Real Madrid's defense, because Atletico and Real Madrid were going to say that, no, we were entitled to sign these guys. Barcelona's defense was something like, well, this ban shouldn't exist. This isn't protection of minors. This is harassment of minors. Why should a young Korean kid, simply by virtue of the fact that he was born in Korea, why should he be denied the sporting opportunities that a young Catalan kid would enjoy? We're not exploiting them. We take good care of them.
I'm very sympathetic to that argument. You can sort of understand the basis of the rule, which is that young people will be put under great psychological pressure at a very young age if their entire family decamps to a new country in order for them to pursue their footballing careers. But I just feel that the best judge of whether or not that is too much pressure weighed against the opportunity that would exist in joining an academy with the track record of Barcelona should be down to the parents. And if the parents feel that it is worth moving and that the young person can cope with it and that they're going to have an opportunity they wouldn't otherwise enjoy, it seems to me it should be the parent who makes the decision. I would rather the authorities, FIFA, although not the best governing body in sport, should be more spending its time looking at regulating the academies to make sure that young people are properly looked after, that they can pursue their education in addition to their football, that there's proper mentoring and supervision and loco parentis, rather than a blanket rule that I think Barcelona are right to say does prevent young people from pursuing opportunities that they wouldn't get in their own home countries.
Obviously, Barcelona have a sterling track record, but the rule exists, I think, probably for two reasons. One is that, to me, the Korean kid that Barcelona got, he was at a club in Korea, and because there's no compensation paid at that age, there's no mechanism for it. And they're like, well, we looked after this kid from the time he was 8, and now we get nothing back and he gets to go to Barcelona. That's not fair. But largely because there's a feeling that, you know, it's great if, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Kim from Seoul make this informed decision about the kid. But the problem starts when, you know, somebody goes to Nigeria and rounds up 50 kids and puts them in a container and hopes that one out of those 50 will go and play in the third division. You can't have minimum requirements, but you can't have, you know, one rule for Barcelona because they're virtuous and another rule for, say, Huddersfield.
Who are also equally virtuous, just clearly less gifted. Yeah, I agree with Matthew saying to an extent, but also I can see why the rule is in place. You say the parents are the best judge, but if those parents are offered a new house in another country or a new job, or if they're being really old school, big brown envelopes, it's almost impossible for them to make the right decision based on the child's interest. And also I think it's important to protect the smaller clubs. There's this growing trend for the biggest clubs just to sort of swoop up all the young talent, and evidence suggests it's not necessarily the best to developing those children. Chelsea, for example, take the best kids they can, and their record of actually developing them beyond 18, 19 is very poor.
There's a lot of myth-making about youth development in football. Barcelona's argument is an extension of the same argument that's used behind EPPP, which is the Premier League's theory.
Elite Player Performance Plan.
The catchily titled EPPP, which is that if you gather as many talented young footballers together as possible, that will help them. Now, there is, without question, a logic to that, that it drives them on. If you speak to people at Barcelona's academy, which is no longer La Masia, and people need to stop calling it La Masia.
La Masia.
Well, whatever you want to say, but it's not there. That's now just a building. If you're a Barcelona kid, training is more use than a football match, because you only play two or three proper games against proper opposition a year. Most of the time you're beating tiny Catalan regional clubs 15-0. It's training where you pick up the edge. So there is a logic there. Look at the pattern of youth development in football. The countries that produce players are not the ones with state-of-the-art facilities. They're not the ones with centralised plans. It sounds really romantic and a bit ridiculous, but Brazil and Argentina, they don't have these facilities. They don't have these sort of overriding structures. I don't think that it's necessarily the sort of panacea that it's presented as. I would personally ban all international transfers under the age of 18, unless you can prove specifically, the burden of proof has to be that it's in the young player's best interest.
There's different ways of doing things as well. I mean, one of the clubs on my patch, Middlesbrough, have got an absolutely fantastic academy system, and it's been brilliant for 20 years. And I mean, they have a self-imposed ban. I'll get the details wrong, but that's never stopped me before. but I think they have I think it's a 40-mile radius or 50-mile radius from the Riverside Stadium. That's where they recruit their players from. Now, Teesside has an absolutely brilliant youth league. I think it's the Teesside Youth League. I think it's the biggest in Europe. I might be wrong on that, but I think that's right. So they've got the benefit of that. But that's part of their philosophy, and that's part of their identity, is that they're, you know, they're taking it seriously at home, and there is then a benefit for the local community too, because they're producing educated young men to kind of go back into society, whether they make it or not, as footballers.
Should the clubs really be the ones growing the talent, or, you know, are they the best suited to do it from a social perspective?
It's always worth bearing in mind that it's a vanishingly small proportion of those who make it into the upper echelons of football. It's extraordinarily small. So it's very, very important that the young players and their parents are aware that the probability of them making a huge amount of money from football is small, and that increases the motivation to want to do lots of other things like education and other kinds of personal development in case they don't make it. But I also think that it is in the interest of the clubs to create individuals who are rounded and have wider intellectual capacities, because I think that makes for better footballers. And also reassures the player that when they get to the end of their career, there will be exit routes out of football when they get into their 30s and they have retirement, rather than something which is a terrible tragedy in English football, which is, if the ex-pro, the organisation that looks after ex-professionals, if their statistics are even close to being accurate, you know, lots of bankruptcies, lots of divorce, lots of other issues, which I think is a real scourge in English football.
How about some quick hits? Chelsea draw 3-3 at home with Everton thanks to a dramatic late equaliser from their captain, brave John Terry. It's Roy of the Rovers stuff, except it was probably offsides, and it wasn't that long ago that a 3-3 draw at home to Everton would be seen as a complete failure. Hughesy, if you're Goose Hiddink, what positives do you take?
John Terry's still alive. They don't like losing. They've got this kind of muscle memory that tries to get them out of trouble in desperate situations, but their attacking was awful for 60 minutes, the defending was bad for 90, and they do not look like a team who's going to get up that table and stay there.
Starting the game with Cesc being the only guy who can pass on the pitch when you have Oscar and Matic and Mikel, I mean, what the hell, you're playing Everton at home,
right? Yeah, it was a strange team. His obsession with Mikel is getting a bit worrying.
Yeah, I know. I want to see Loftus-Cheek, man. Everton probably should have won this game. Rory, Roberto Martinez, or Martinez as you call him, confuses me. I thought they actually played relatively well, but then they somehow conceded three goals and they let the game slip away. Several people I know and respect have told me that he's actually a complete fraud of a Van Gaal type nature. I don't want to believe that. Can you convince me otherwise or shed some light on his issues?
He is not a fraud. That's ridiculous. But his problem is that his team keeps conceding goals in the last minute of injury time, and occasionally they need to be a little bit more cynical. I think his loyalty to his principles is obviously admirable, but there's always a time and a place. And I hate it when teams like run the ball into the corner in the last minute, but occasionally you kind of see why they do that. It's happened to them twice now that they've let in late goals. A third time would be unfortunate.
I might have told this story before, for which I apologise, but there is a fairly high-profile manager who tells a nice story about Martinez. He says, "I want Roberto to speak at my funeral because he'll persuade the audience that I'm still alive."
Tottenham Hotspur stay on track, beating up Sunderland 4-1. But George, I had an eye on this game, and I thought Sunderland actually better than the score suggests. Can you give me some hope that they'll stay up? Because I've kind of been enjoying this Big Sam-led mini-revival.
Well, if you want hope, they've done it before, year after year after bloody year. Exactly the same thing. I think they've got the right manager in Sam Allardyce. They've got a good, exciting young keeper in Jordan Pickford. So that's about it, really.
Jordan Pickford, who's played, what, one game?
Yeah.
Two games?
Well, I'm looking for... I suppose I chose to answer a different question, or a shorter question was, can you give me some hope?
They've got a goal machine in Jermaine Defoe. Yeah. They have a large man in Ola Toivonen.
They have a large man.
They have an even bigger man in Quartus.
Spurs stay on track, beating Sunderland 4-1.
Yeah, okay.
But they actually play. You give me hope. They've got a large man.
No, I actually thought they're well organized. I think both Brown and O'Shea have kind of jumped the shark, and I'd like to see them get centre back.
They've got Jan Kirchhoff.
Yeah, no. But maybe they need another one. I don't. This is a good point. I'd forgotten about Kirchhoff. But they're not bad players, and they're well set up. I saw them at Chelsea where he got everything wrong.
They're quite bad.
I struggle to find the third team to go down after Villa and Newcastle.
What? Newcastle and Sunderland. I'm going to be out of a job. This is going to be my last appearance on the podcast.
Well, Middlesbrough coming up, aren't they?
Yeah. But...
Gates head? No. Manchester City romp to a 4-0 win over Crystal Palace. Husey, you can either praise City and tell me if they've rediscovered their mojo, or you can tell me why Palace seem to be in free fall now and if it's just God punishing Alan Pardew.
Could well be. City are getting better. No coincidence that Aguero's been fit-ish for a month now and he's started to score goals. When him and Silva are fit and firing, they're a different team. They just need to now be consistent and put together back-to-back wins, which they haven't done for a while, which is odd.
Leicester City are held at Aston Villa 1-1, but they sort of contrived to throw this one away with Riyad Mahrez missing a penalty and then conceding a silly equaliser. Rory, they're still tied with Arsenal for the league lead. This is the same question we've asked every single week. Are they running out of steam?
No.
Thank you for giving a different answer.
Leicester are probably not going to win the title. It's worth noting that if Riyad Mahrez scores his penalties, they're 4 points clear of Arsenal at the top. So they are...
3 points clear.
No, it'd be two wins rather than two draws. Stores against Bournemouth and Stores against Villa.
Right,
4 points.
Right.
I still, like everybody else, expect them to run out of steam at some point. I think that Ranieri said that Mahrez is finding it harder because he's getting much more attention from defenders and he's finding it difficult to cope with that. But I think the way this season's gone and the way they're set up, I wouldn't necessarily expect them to fall away sort of quickly. I think they will fall away, but it'll be a gradual process. They're still joint top.
Who's going to catch them? Because exactly. Spurs and United, Liverpool, none of them can put a run together.
Well, didn't Van Gaal say United can still win the title?
Yeah, but he's got, you know.
All right. Newcastle United overcome West Ham, who of course won the World Cup. They now have Jonjoe Shelvey pulling the strings in midfield. George, is this what's known in technical terms as a game changer?
I don't know. 22 years of reporting Newcastle would suggest no. And think, but he was very good. He played a couple of brilliant balls forward. There was a bit of spikiness there. And Do you know what? It was just a fun day at St James's Park, and came on the back of a decent performance in the draw with Man United. It was just nice to be there. Can't say that too often.
It's so pleasant because of the personal touch to it.
Gab, one for you. You wrote a truly wonderful column about the European Super League and how it might not be dead and buried. Tell us more.
Thank you, Rory. I will happily do that. There's a man named Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, who used to be a stellar striker for Inter Milan and Bayern Munich, who is also the chairman of Bayern Munich today. But he's the president of the European Clubs Association. And he spoke out at a meeting last week in Milan where he said, well, I don't think you can rule out a European Super League, whether under the auspices of UEFA or privately run by the clubs. And this is probably the nightmare that keeps a lot of people up at night, because we thought that we'd lick this in the late 90s. But it would be some sort of NBA-style thing with the 20 biggest clubs in Europe, although we'd probably refer to them as franchises. It would be closed system, no promotion, no relegation. And they offered some supporting arguments for this, such as the fact that the NFL generates some £5.4 billion a year in TV revenue, whereas the little old Champions League only manages £1.2 billion. So clearly, they're leaving a lot of money on the table, and the big clubs are pushing for this. Now, are they going to threaten a breakaway, whatever? No, I think they're posturing. But I think it's the old thing when, you know, you ask for a lot so that you can get a little. I think what they would like, and they've made no mystery of this, is perhaps a different allocation of resources, perhaps extra spots for the bigger teams in the bigger leagues so that the gap between rich and poor can grow. Perhaps even some kind of wild card that you could play. So, for example, if a historically big club like AC Milan or Manchester United fail to qualify for the Champions League one year, they can say, aha, look, we're United, you will let us in. Or we're AC Milan, you'll let us in. I think that's what they're angling for. For all his ills, I think UEFA have done a pretty decent job of keeping this idea at bay because the Champions League revenue has grown and whatever. But right now, of course, Platini is banned from football. And the Secretary General at UEFA, Gianni Infantino, is busy running for president of FIFA. So there is a bit of a power vacuum. And if Platini doesn't come back, and I'm not sure he will, there'll be new elections. And depends how big club friendly the new president is. I think this is one situation to keep an eye on. Rory, we gave you a task earlier in this show to come up with a person of the size and body type of Christian Benteke who actually presses well. Have you come up with one?
No.
Okay.
Can you think of one?
Well, I wasn't asked to think of one, but if somebody wants to tweet in.
Heskey pressed quite well. Yeah, that's true. Heskey could press.
Think about Emil Heskey's. He wasn't quite as big as you.
No, but neither is Benteke. Benteke's, if you meet them, I mean, Heskey's a big bloke. If you meet footballers, they're never as big as they look on TV.
Husey gets 3 house points.
There you go. Well done, Husey.
We didn't have houses at my school.
Really?
Barely had buildings.
They had bungalows.
Did they have houses at your school?
Yeah, of course.
Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my excellent guests today, Rory K. Smith, Matt Hughes, coming down all the way from the Northeast to be with you today, George Culkin, and of course, Matthew Syed. Now, you please, please go and press that subscribe button. We're going to be back next week. But by the way, before I go, remember, you can get exclusive football highlights for free as part of your subscription. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. It's pretty neat. You don't have to sit around and wait for Match of the Day or Sky or whatever it is that you want to watch. You can see the goals. Just search The Times online. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.